Did you know 64% of employers added a family building benefit because an employee asked for it? No matter the size of your organization, you have the power to make a difference for current and future employees. Want to know where to start? Progyny is here to help. Progyny is a family building benefits company that has been helping employees and employers advocate for increased access to effective and equitable fertility and family building benefits for over 7 years. To get the resources that can help you make a difference, visit progyny.com/talktohr today. For this episode, we partnered with Needed, the leading women's health supplement brand recommended by nutritionally trained practitioners. Did you know that 95% of women who take prenatals are still nutrient deficient? Most prenatals are designed to meet bare minimum needs, not to optimally nourish you. We love that Needed's products are based on the latest clinical research and that they focus on care before, during, and after pregnancy. Support your body with radically better nutrition and save 20% off your first month at thisisneeded.com with code FDU.
You're listening to the Fertility Docs Uncensored podcast, featuring insight on all things fertility from some of the top-rated doctors around America. Whether you're struggling to conceive or just planning for your future family, we're here to guide you every step of the way.
Hi, everyone. We're back with another episode of Fertility Docs Uncensored. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Abby Eblen from Nashville Fertility Center, and I am joined today by my lovely and charming co-host and friends, Dr. Susan Hudson from Texas Fertility Center.
Hello, everybody.
And Dr. Carrie Beaton from the Las Vegas Fertility Center of Las Vegas. I can't believe I screwed that up, Carrie. Fertility Center of Las Vegas.
It's been a long time since we've garbled each other's clinic names.
I know. We have like 200 plus
episodes.
We've had a
really good streak.
I don't know. I know. That's what I'm kind of on autopilot now. I should have paid more attention. So with that being said, what have you guys been up to? You doing okay?
Yeah. Kind of living life and seeing patients and writing our book, and flowers are starting to bloom here in Texas. And it's
now that the weather's starting to get nice, what do you guys like to do? What's the fun thing you like to do in the spring?
I get out in my yard and start getting obsessive about my rose plants and my, like, all my succulents and, you know, trimming everything back and planting and all of that. So I like getting my hands dirty and planting all my vegetables and stuff like that.
So roses grow in Las Vegas? I didn't know that.
Absolutely. Beautifully,
really?
Actually. Yeah.
See, because I thought roses were very finicky plants, and I would think that all that that they like the heat, I guess.
They like the heat. You kind of got to be careful so they don't get sunburned in the heat of the summer, but there's...
You put sunscreen on their little petals to make sure they don't get sunburned?
Every day.
Sunblock.
there's a couple of, ironically, iceberg roses in Las Vegas are the ones that are the hardiest because they're these beautiful white plants that exist with something in the soil. As the flowers get deeper into the season, they start getting pink and like on the edges. Yeah, it's really pretty. But I just planted last fall, a set that I'm hoping... they're all red and yellow and pink. And so I'm hoping that they made it through the winter okay, because it's like you have to prune them down to sticks and it always makes me like I'm violating them. Yeah.
That's kind of like hydrangeas around here. Hydrangeas, same sort of thing. You prune them down to the sticks, and then they also can change colors during the season when they, depending on whether the soil is, you know, basic or acidic, they can be pink or blue, which is really kind of cool.
That's cool.
So Susan, what's your big thing you like to do in the spring?
I am not nearly as much of a green thumb as you guys are, which I envy people like you. But I have to say, one of my favorite parts of the spring is, as many of you know, I have two offices, one in New Braunfels and one in Corpus Christi, that is about 2.5 hours apart. But they're through some pretty different, it's flat geography, but the weather and the humidity and the temperature and the winds and everything are all very different. And because of that, my drive between my two cities is beautiful, beautiful, beautiful in the spring. So I don't know if you're from outside of Texas, you probably don't know this, but Lady Bird Johnson, one of her major things that she did when she was first lady was she helped plant Texas wildflowers.
And interesting.
Every spring, The wildflowers in Texas are just absolutely beautiful. And it's fun.
Yeah.
It goes through different seasons. So you start off with the blue bonnets and you have, and then the Indian paintbrushes, and then you start getting some more of the yellow flowers. And so as the season goes on, it sort of evolves, and they do not cut the grass on the Texas highways until the entire wildflower season has gone through. So
that's cool.
And then everything gets cut down and everything like that. So I love Texas wildflower season.
Yeah.
The fact that I get to experience it every couple of weeks when I drive back and forth from New Braunfels to Corpus is really neat. It is something
awesome. Good for Lady Bird. Good job, Lady Bird.
Yeah.
Well, I like to go to craft fairs. We have a lot of craft fairs around here in the spring. We have the Tennessee Arts and Crafts Festival, and we have a couple other ones. It's just, that's my favorite thing, because you get to enjoy the beautiful outdoors and you get to shop. Two of my favorite things. All right. So today we are going to do a whole big episode on questions. Our questions today are going to be related to decreased ovarian reserve. And so, Susan, have you got some questions for us?
Yeah. Actually, before we get started, do we want to explain kind of what exactly is diminished ovarian reserve or decreased ovarian reserve?
Sure. Carrie?
So,
what's decreased ovarian reserve?
When we are going through all of the testing with you, we know that ovaries have all the eggs that they're ever going to have in them since before birth. So when you're like halfway through getting ready to be born, so right around the 20-week mark of the pregnancy while you are still in your mama's belly, the eggs are at their peak, which is like 20 million or so. By the time you're born, it drops down to 1 to 2 million. By the time you hit puberty, it's approximately 300 to 500,000. By the time you hit menopause, it's usually like 1,000 or less. And that's average age is 51 in the United States. And so we expect those numbers to decrease over time. And there's a couple ways that we measure them, whether it's looking at your FSH hormones to see how your brain is instructing your ovaries to produce them, whether it's your AMH, which is this total storage hormone amount that gives us an idea if we're low, medium, or high levels, or a follicle count, which is the ultrasound to show how many eggs are sitting there available to grow. So we've got kind of set ideas of what we expect to see in different age ranges. Decreased ovarian reserve refers to when those levels are all in pretty low reserve, such that we don't have a whole lot of backup to rely on. And so sometimes that happens naturally, like when women are in their 40s, where we expect low ovarian reserve at that point. And sometimes it happens prematurely when women are in their teens, 20s, 30s, or even their 40s when they hit menopause earlier, or they just have markedly lower levels than what we would expect.
Very good. Very good. All right. So our first one is, hi, ladies. I recently discovered your podcast and I'm trying to binge as many episodes as I can. Thank you so much. That's very sweet.
Yay.
I'm 34 years old with an AMH of 0.3, AFC of 2, FSH of 9.6. I never got my period back after removing my Mirena IUD in 2022, so I've been taking Provera to induce periods. For my first IVF cycle, my RE recommended doing either estrogen priming or androgel priming. I haven't been able to find much information about testosterone priming. Would you be able to share your thoughts on this and how well it works for DOR? Do you recommend this as a first-line treatment in your own patients? Thank you for all you do.
I've never used that for priming for somebody with DOR. Now, I know that DHEA has been used sometimes to kind of help, and I'm not really sure the mechanism, but we think it may help somehow the eggs develop. But generally, I don't think that works great. I think if that worked great, we'd all be doing it. So generally, I don't think there's really a way to prime your eggs. Now, sometimes we'll start patients on estrace, particularly before they do IVF, to kind of synchronize the eggs that they have, because sometimes patients with decreased ovarian reserve, when they get stimulated, particularly with IVF, may have a follicle that we call a dominant follicle, where maybe they have two or three other ones, but they have one that shoots out way ahead of the other ones. And so sometimes using estrace starting in the second half of your cycle, in the previous cycle, we hope or think that may help kind of synchronize the eggs together.
I don't do a whole lot of of androgen priming. I mean, I don't think it causes any problems. Certainly our PCOS patients have pretty high androgen levels walking around, and that doesn't do them any harm during an IVF cycle. Androgens do get converted over to estrogen. So I tend to go straight for the estrogen just because there's no questionable side effects to estrogens. When you're working with androgens, even if you get the hormonal response that you want, if you end up with additional hair growth or some of the androgen related changes, women deep are not voice. Super happy. Yeah, deeper voice, hair loss, things like that, and male pattern baldness, all of that. And you're unlikely to hit that with just a short course of estrogen leading into it. But even so, like, you've gone through a lot of hormonal chaos. That's not my particular favorite. But there are some people who automatically go to it. It was a lot more popular, I would say, 5-8 years ago, something like that.
I've seen a resurgence of it. I don't do any androgen priming. I'm like you guys, I go to the estrogen, and I don't think that some of the side effects we mentioned are things that are actually irreversible. So it's you do have to be careful with. And so, but I've seen kind of a resurgence of people who have, you know, been to other clinics and now they're coming to me or something like that, and that have been using androgens as priming, but it's not something that I've really focused on. Okie doke, our next one. Hey guys, had a question in regard to a comment you made about screening AMH levels prior to IUI. I'm a 26-year-old female with so far unexplained infertility. My RE took cycle day 3 labs and found an FSH of 10 and an AMH of 0.69. Whoa. HSG showed open tubes with fairly large polyp that he removed hysteroscopically 2 months ago. We just had our first round of IUI fail with Clomid. I have regular cycles. I was just wanting to know the significance of my AMH levels when doing IUI and how optimistic I should be about our next round. Thank you. I enjoy your podcast so much. Thank you so much.
Yay! You know, I try and tell patients there's really two factors now when we look at female age. There's egg quality and egg number. And, you know, there's not a lot of great data to show that if you have an egg every month, if you ovulate an egg every month, that you have a really significant impact on your fertility. And in fact, I will say when we first started doing AMH levels, we counseled patients incorrectly. We would say, oh gosh, it's like you're a 40-year-old, even though you're 26 with this AMH that's abnormal, it's like you're a 40-year-old. We know now that's really not true. We know that it purely means that you have a lower egg count. That's more important when you do IVF, because at 26, typically we'd expect, I don't know, like 12 to 15 eggs. If you did IVF, we might only get 4 or 5, but those 4 or 5 eggs are still going to act like a 26-year-old. So, you know, I would still keep doing what you're doing for a few months. And, you know, I think regroup at the end of 3 or 4 tries with your OBGYN and talk to the, or with your REI and talk to them about kind of what next steps are. But I don't think I would necessarily, even though I would agree your AMH is abnormal and your FSH is kind of high as well, borderline high, I still think that, you know, I think it's reasonable to try some things in the office first and then move on to IVF potentially, you know, in a few months. But just don't go away for 6 months or a year or whatever. Keep moving forward.
So first of all, I don't think you have unexplained infertility.
Right. Okay. I agree. Yeah. It's not unexplained. It's explained.
you have diminished ovarian reserve. Okay. Yes. And so a lot of this also, I think part of the conversation is, what are your family goals? Okay.
Yes. Because
if you're wanting more than one child, our problem is, even though, like Abby said, you still have some eggs and that type of thing, we don't know if your ovaries are aging faster or if they just took a hit when you were younger at some point in time. Okay. And so if you're wanting to have more than one child, I think that sitting down and having a conversation about potentially freezing eggs or embryos for the future would be some time well spent.
I would agree with that. The main thing I was thinking about was family planning, as we've been talking about this, is make sure that if you want more than one kid, you're taking advantage of the time that you have now, because I would much rather have one egg from a 26-year-old than have 10 eggs from a 46-year-old.
That's right.
But think about how that's going to impact. Now, it's also entirely possible to have DOR and get pregnant naturally. Uh-huh. You know, I remember a story from fellowship where this patient had one ovary and had pretty low numbers, and she was terrified that she was going to need a bunch of help, and 3 kids. Totally fine. Didn't need us at all. So
Unfortunately, yeah, say, none of us have their crystal ball to say which ballpark are you going to fall into.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I always say there's no AMH at which I can guarantee that you will be pregnant. There's no AMH at which I can guarantee that you won't be pregnant. So, but yeah, I'd like to have a normal AMH. That would be optimal if we could choose.
All right. Our next question kind of follows along these lines. Hi, I'm 28 and seeing my OB-GYN for irregular periods, and she ran some hormone tests on me, which resulted in a low AMH, 0.95. She recommended I see a fertility specialist, and I've had various diagnostic tests done so far. Everything was normal. She gave us a whole bunch of values, but day 3 ultrasounds showed 2 to 4 follicles. FSH was 6.9. In 2016, I had iodine deficiency, but it hasn't been tested since. At that time, I was told I would have a difficult time conceiving. I am now recently married and afraid I'm going to struggle to create a family. Do you think I should consider freezing my eggs since we weren't planning on having children right away, maybe in a year or so?
I would freeze embryos, not eggs. I think
Why, Carrie?
So, so there's like layers to this answer. So eggs compared to embryos, eggs are further up in the funnel. You want to get down as deep into that funnel as you can, because if you start with a very large number of eggs, you are going to end up with a very small number, usually, of embryos, or at least a smaller number. And so when you're starting with a smaller number, then it's a lot more questionable what you're going to end up with. Age plays a huge impact on this. You know, someone who's in their 20s is going to respond differently than 30s and 40s. But if you have a dedicated person and you're pretty sure that this is the person you want to make babies with, then it makes more sense to combine with the sperm, get the embryos, because you're going to go down that funnel. Because it is entirely possible that, you know, out of 4 eggs, you might get 2 euploid embryos. But you
What's euploid, Carrie?
Genetically normal. But you don't know that until you get there, because it's also entirely possible that you could have 4 eggs and 0 embryos. And so until you know that, you don't know what you're working with. And so I would definitely lean on the freezing embryos if you can, because anybody who is smart enough and together enough and organized enough to think about this before it becomes a problem, you should do something about it. And especially if you want multiple kids, like, plan for it now. If you never use them, it's fine. Like, just if you don't need them, that's great. We can have that conversation, but, you know, make sure that you can build the family that you want.
But the other thing nice that is available, that if for some reason you have hesitancy about creating embryos ahead of time, freezing eggs is better than doing nothing. So
don't
freeze yourself into inaction because maybe you're concerned about creating embryos or something like that. Freeze something. The further along you get, the more likely you're going to get a baby from that egg or embryo.
Mm-hmm. Good point. And
keep in mind, freezing eggs, you will likely require multiple cycles, because when they've run the numbers, there was a study that showed for a 75% chance of getting pregnant at age 34, you needed about 10 eggs. At 37, it was 20. Early 40s, 41, 42, you needed about 60. So when you're only making 2 to 4 per cycle, it's going to take a little longer, more cycles, to get up to the recommended number of eggs if it truly is eggs that you're going to go with.
Absolutely.
Receptiva DX is a powerful test that can help detect inflammatory conditions on the uterine lining that might be preventing you from becoming pregnant or staying pregnant. If you've experienced implantation failure or recurrent pregnancy loss, ask your doctor about Receptiva DX testing. If found, uterine inflammation can be treated, providing a new pathway to achieving a successful pregnancy. Receptiva DX, because the journey's worth it.
All right, our next one. Hi, docs. I'm 33 years old, looking for input on my fertility situation. After trying to conceive for 9 months with 24 to 30 day cycles, we found out I have severe DOR, AMH 0.15 to 0.61, FSH 5.7, HSG normal, semen analysis great. Quickly went to IVF using estrogen priming protocol. Baseline had 9 follicles. However, only 3 follicles responded to meds. Did 150 of Menopur and 300 of Gonal F, and only 1 egg retrieved and did not fertilize naturally. Where do we go from here? RA suggests a microflare protocol, but we are hesitant to try another high-dose stem cycle that includes birth control. Should a lesser stimulation protocol or even Clomid IUI be better for someone who doesn't respond to IVF protocols?
I would say you can, there's always different ways that we can treat the protocol, and I would try IVF. I don't think IUI is going to be a good use of your time and your, you know, your eggs. I would really still try and get your OB-GYN to tweak that and see if you they can do better. Because as we said before, you know, I think all of us, when we see a patient back, we after doing an IVF cycle, we rarely do the exact same cycle. Even when I have a patient that has a great response, sometimes I'm like, well, do I want to tweak something just a little bit? So I would really give your OB or your REI credit and kind of let them look at it and talk about it. I think a microdose Lupron flare protocol was a protocol that we probably used routinely in poor responders maybe 8 or 10 years ago. And we realized for some patients, more is not always better. But if you don't respond to the newer protocol with antagonists, then sometimes more is better. So if it were me personally, I would lean toward doing a microdose Lupron flare because it's a little bit different. It involves you producing your own endogenous FSH in addition to just slamming you with a bunch of FSH. And sometimes that's what it takes to really get your eggs to stimulate. And I personally would probably not use birth control pills, although when microdose Lupron flares were kind of in their heyday, a lot of people would use birth control pills. I think for the same reason that we do estrogen priming now to kind of synchronize the egg development to try and prevent a dominant follicle from developing. I personally don't like to use birth control pills in people that are already, you know, already have a low egg count just because I'm afraid you're right. They won't stimulate very well.
I really like the microdose Lupron flare. I think it's a reasonable place to go, particularly because it's not like you started with 2 to 3 follicles and you only ended up with one and it didn't work. You started with 9. So the question is, can we get those 9 to grow? And sometimes it is a function of a different protocol. Sometimes it's a function of just doing it again because your body has just gotten a crash course on, oh, this is what we're supposed to be doing? Okay. And sometimes people respond really well to the second cycle, not necessarily making a difference as to what the actual protocol is. It's just you are getting enough to let your ovaries respond and say, oh, okay, we'll play with you this time. So I think that makes sense. I will oftentimes use birth control pills leading into this particular cycle. There's when you're going in a cycle and you're only using them for, you know, 1-2 weeks, something like that, a short period of time to get all of the eggs together. And so they start running their race at the same time. I tend not to mind that. I really don't like people on birth control pills for a prolonged period of time. I think that is detrimental, especially when you already have a low count. But for a short period of time, I don't think it has an impact. But once you get, you know, a month or two or more, then that's more negative.
Yeah, I think either way you can go there. The data says that doing more than 450 units a day doesn't make a difference. I can say I don't always play by that rule. So
yeah, I mean, I've seen where it has.
I saw you and I did 450 units on you the first time. I was going to slam you the next time with 300 is what I would honestly do.
Yeah.
I would even consider adding some letrozole or Clomid, sometimes both, to that stimulation and just getting your endogenous, which means coming from your body, and exogenous, coming from your little injections, all that FSH to hit your little ovaries as hard as you can. So, you know, I think that low dose protocols are good for people who we know. So if your antral follicle count was only 2 or 3 and you got 2 or 3 and you're like, I really don't want to use that much medication, I think that's a much stronger argument than I had 9 follicles and I want to do less medications. That argument doesn't make a lot of sense in my mind, at least.
Yeah.
So, all right, good stuff. Our next one. Good afternoon. I am switching fertility docs clinics to move from IVF to donor eggs. My doc runs the only fertility clinic where I live and have to drive a bit to the next city for an egg donor clinic. Without paying the $350 consultation fee for 5 different clinics, how can I assess pick the clinic for me? It's becoming a little like online dating with reviews on the dates, good or bad. Thank you.
So online reviews of medical facilities are...
Don't put a lot of weight in those.
Because one of the things that you oftentimes see is there's more emphasis placed on the non-medical components of your care, which, while they are important, after a certain point, it doesn't matter. It's does your doc and their team, can they get done what you need to have done?
Perfect.
And so Be careful with the reviews. You know, it, obviously, if every single one is terrible, slamming them because, you know, they devour their patients and whatever, that's one thing. But be careful with the online reviews.
One of my rules of thumb is most people who are writing online reviews are people who are not happy. So the happy people are generally off doing whatever they want to, and they're not writing reviews.
Going to their OB doctor because they're pregnant.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just like if you buy a refrigerator, I love my refrigerator. Am I going to go write a review about my refrigerator? No.
What about your Stanley Cup, Susan? Would you write a review about your Stanley Cup?
I love my Stanley Cup. But no, I'm not going to write a review about it. Now, if I was upset about something, I would be way more likely to write a review. So that's something about that. But to kind of get to the heart of the matter of what she's trying to find out, I think there's some important questions you can ask on the phone before you go into the clinic, because you're specifically trying to find out about their donor egg pool. Mm-hmm. And so finding out if they have their own donor egg program, is it a fresh egg program versus a frozen egg program? Do they work with other egg donor banks, and which ones are those? And if they have their own programs, how many people do they have, whether it's, you know, fresh donors, or how many lots do they have available for frozen donors? Or if you're looking for certain ethnic diversity in your donors, you can ask about those things. So I think those are all things you can do on the phone before making that $350 consult. Carrie?
I would say probably one of the best for this type of thing is go look around. And I always hesitate telling patients to go to the like the CDC website to look at numbers, because those numbers from a patient's perspective, hell, even from a clinic and a physician perspective, they are hard to understand, because there's ways that they get nuanced that are not particularly accurate. But what you are looking for is someone who does a high volume of donor, because donor is different than when you're trying to get a woman's own, her own eggs. There's a lot more administrative stuff that goes along with it. There's a lot more regulatory stuff that goes along with it. And so you don't want somebody who does onesie twosies every year. You want someone who has
a bunch
department dedicated to it. And granted, like, I see that because we do a fair amount, and we've got staff that's dedicated, and they really good at know it, and they function very differently than the local IVF who, you know, they're using their own eggs. And so, you know, you want someone who does this all day, every day, because they're going to catch the things that will make your donation better. Like, they'll catch a donor like, I wouldn't use that one. Or they'll be used to the screening. They'll be used to working with donors, particularly if you're going through a fresh cycle, because the donors are just inherently different than women who are going through this from themselves. Not in a bad way. It's just a, you know, if she's a 24-year-old girl, her priorities and her life are very different. So you need people who are used to working with that to make sure that everybody gets through this, you know, safely and with the desired outcome.
And I would just second what you're saying about a place that does a lot of it and is really experienced with it. I had a patient that came to see me a few years ago that they wanted to transfer their embryos to Nashville because they'd moved here. But because of some issue with screening, the embryos weren't screened correctly. And the clinic still let them do the transfers there. We probably wouldn't have accepted them. A lot of people wouldn't have accepted them. So you really want a center that's really dedicated to doing it. And the other just word of advice, just as a side note, is this is going to take a long time. There's lots of steps involved. It's a lot of moving parts. And so, again, it'll take a while on the front end. But just know that if you're in the hands of somebody that does a lot of these, you'll know that you're taken care of.
No cutting corners for that one.
All right. Our next one. Hi, your podcast has been a very helpful tool while going through infertility struggles. I'm 33 years old with a 2.5-year-old son. My husband, 34, and I've been trying for just over a year. I do take Synthroid 75 micrograms. After further testing with our RA, I found out my day 3 AMH is 0.8, FSH is 9.3, estradiol 22, AFC 15, no thyroid antibodies. My progesterone has always been the low side, rarely getting over 6 on day 21 testing. I did have spontaneous pregnancy July 23 that ended in miscarriage just shy of 8 weeks. We are moving forward with IUI with Clomid and then Apeer with the Navadrol trigger. What are your thoughts on that treatment plan, or should I be more aggressive due to my low AMH level?
Wait, she said Clomid, Menopur with Ava trigger for IUI or IVF?
That's what IUI. I was wondering.
IUI.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. She's essentially saying, is a combo cycle with IUI a reasonable thing to do based on her AMH level?
Yeah. And this goes back to question number two, I think, that you guys said, and I agree. It depends on, and she has a 2.5-year-old, and she recently got pregnant and had a miscarriage. And, you know, I mean, even people that have great AMHs can have miscarriages, but it depends on kind of what your goals are, how many kiddos you want to have, I think. Back to what Kieran Susan said a minute ago.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't think you lose anything by trying. And that's a reasonable protocol that I think a lot of us.
Yeah,
absolutely. All right. Hi, ladies. I'm 33, preparing for my first round of IVF after discovering I have DOR, AMH 0.15 to 0.6, AFC 4 to 6. My questions are there autoimmune deficiencies or genetic diseases that cause low ovarian reserve? Does my low AMH mean I am closer to menopause? I'm 135 pounds, ovulate regularly, never smoke or drink, no past surgeries, FSH 5.7, vitamin D, thyroid A1C normal, ANA positive, negative for fragile X, chromosome karyotypes normal. I struggle with anxiety and depression, uniquely have gray hair since age 14. I can't help but wonder if these two premature aging issues are somehow linked. For what it's worth, my mother had kids at ages 38, 41, and 43, all conceived naturally.
All right, Susan, you're the autoimmune expert.
Yeah, and she kind of answered her own question, too, about fragile X.
I mean, I have to say that autoimmune conditions do run together, okay? I actually just read something this last week that there is a new gene that they have discovered on the X chromosome that may give us more answers as to why women tend to have more autoimmune diseases than men do. We definitely see that in our practices.
Yeah.
So could your premature graying and your diminished ovarian reserve be related? I think we would all say absolutely yes. Can we tell you for sure? No.
Right.
you know, but it's one of those things that we definitely see things like that go together.
All right. One more.
Okay. First, thank you so much for your podcast. I'm 40 years old and have been trying to become a single mother by choice for the past year. Backstory, low AMH, 0.6. Never tried to get pregnant naturally. Have had two egg retrievals. First was when I was 35, AMH just above 1, and froze 11 eggs. Antagonist protocol success, ovulated through Lupron flare at first attempt. Second retrieval was at age 39 earlier this year. Antagonist protocol, again, high doses, primed with testosterone and growth hormone. 3 eggs retrieved, many empty follicles, 0 blasts. Then I fertilized my 11 frozen eggs, had 1 blast, euploid, but FET failed. Would you consider IUI as I have never done that, or should I keep doing IVF with low AMH?
Time is running out. I would say I'd keep doing IVF. If you can afford to do it and want to do it, you're going to have the best chance. It's kind of like, you know, if you had just one blastocyst that had been normal, you know, we'd be having a different discussion. So if it were me personally, I'd stay at IVF.
Yeah, I probably would as well. One thing I've noticed for a lot of my single moms by choice, that genetic testing, it's really helpful, both in making sure that you're not wasting time and that you're putting back an embryo that's more likely to succeed, but also because there's oftentimes a stronger need to avoid any kind of chromosomal abnormalities in the embryo and resulting child, because single moms by choice don't necessarily have the same kind of built-in structural backup system who can help them if they're having a miscarriage, if they have a child with special needs, things like that, that end up taking a lot of time and personal energy, and they just find it's more important to be able to do that genetic testing. So I would probably stick with IVF if you can, but if you can't, go to IUI and give it a shot.
Exactly. And I mean, there's relatively good data to say that, you know, when we're doing ovarian reserve testing and you haven't really had sperm exposure, It's questionable how strong it is, but we do know your age is not in favor. So I agree with Carrie and Abby. If you can do IVF, I would. But if you can't and IUI is what you can afford to help you try to achieve your goals, I also don't think that that's a wrong decision.
All right. To our audience, thanks for listening and tune in next week for more. Be sure to subscribe and leave us a review in iTunes. Give us some ideas on our book about IVF that we're writing. Go in and leave us notes on Instagram and Facebook. We'd love to hear from you.
You can also visit us at fertilitydocsuncensored.com to submit specific questions you have about infertility. We'll answer all questions anonymously. And would love to hear from you. If you would like to subscribe, please do so, particularly if you have in a prior time, just make sure it didn't drop off. And yeah, we'll see you soon.
As always, this podcast is intended for entertainment and is not suitable for medical advice from your own physician. All right. We'll talk to you soon. Bye. Bye.
Did you know 64% of employers added a family building benefit because an employee asked for it? No matter the size of your organization, you have the power to make a difference for current and future employees. Want to know where to start? Progyny is here to help. Progyny is a family building benefits company that has been helping employees and employers advocate for increased access to effective and equitable fertility and family building benefits for over 7 years. To get the resources that can help you make a difference, visit progyny.com/talktohr today. Fertility is complex, and while there's a lot we can't control in the journey to parenthood, nutrition is a big one that both partners can. This is why we've teamed up with Needed, a perinatal nutrition company that optimizes nutrition for both partners throughout all stages of pregnancy. They offer a variety of products to support women and their partners on their journey to conception, including their fertility support for two plan. Support your body with radically better nutrition and save 20% off with your first month at thisisneeded.com with code FDU.